Välkomna till Motgångspodden. I detta avsnitt träffar vi Mikaela och Lisa, grundarna av Hack Your Closet. Hej och välkomna till Motgångspodden avsnitt 2, vårt första riktiga avsnitt denna andra säsong. Och i det här avsnittet så har jag med mig Hanna, för Jonas kunde inte vara med. Och Hanna, vilka ska vi träffa i det här avsnittet?
Ja, men superspännande, för idag ska vi träffa grundarna bakom bolaget Hack Your Closet, Lisa och Mikaela, som hade en otroligt spännande affärsmodell som skulle kunna skaka om hela modeindustrin. Bolaget finns tyvärr inte längre, men man utmanade verkligen hur vi konsumerar kläder och på vilket sätt som modeindustrin är uppbyggd genom att erbjuda privatpersoner möjligheten att istället för att gå och köpa nya plagg så kunde man ha ett abonnemang helt enkelt där man då också, vilket jag tycker är spännande eftersom modeindustrin byggs mycket på att saker är nytt och trender och det i sig är väldigt svårt att förena med hållbarhet. Och att du som konsument ändå kan få det samtidigt som du ser till att kläder verkligen kan nyttjas under mycket, mycket längre tid. Så det ska bli superspännande att höra om deras resa och varför det fortfarande 2024 är så svårt att ställa om till en cirkulär ekonomi.
Spännande. Låt oss kasta oss in i världen av fast fashion. Välkomna till Motgångspodden avsnitt 2, säsong 2.
Okay, so welcome to Motgångspodden. And today we have Mikaela and Lisa with us. Thank you so much for joining. Before we get into your story with Hack Your Closet, I would just want to throw it out there. How do you define things such as failures and hitting roadblocks, setbacks? Lisa, what's your take on that?
Well, I would say that, I would almost say that failure is the only way to grow, the only way to develop, but it also depends on what you do with it. Right, it's like if you do a failure and you're gonna repeat the same things again and again, then it's, you can see it as a, not necessarily a positive thing. But if you use that as insights and as you use that as a step forward, then you should make more failure faster.
And Mikaela, what's your take?
Yeah, I think I agree with Lisa. And if you haven't failed, then you haven't risked it enough. So you have to like fail sometimes to be able to say, okay, I really, really tried and we tried different things. We failed and we learned from it and we moved on. But I think that the only time that you actually, as Lisa say, grow as a person and develop in your career and learn new things is through looking back at the mistakes and failures that you had. And I see that as a very positive thing.
And just want to dive a tiny bit further on that, because I think it's just interesting to, given that you've run a company for quite some time, was it different to look at failure like a personal failure and failure in terms of this company, if you understand, like us as an organization, us as a startup?
So I might be a little bit not controversial here, but I don't think I haven't like what we have experienced with AccuCloud is not a failure. So to start with, that's how I don't really see it as a failure. It's an experience. It's part of a journey. I think we know when you're an entrepreneur is that sometimes people hear failure thinking that it's like the end of something, but entrepreneurship is never like it's a journey, it's an experience. It's like, so I mean, we can use the word failure as 1,000 times today, but I don't believe that what we achieved at Hack Your Closet is one of them. While I can tell you that I have failed a lot in my personal life, and I was almost, you know, I mean, you know, when you fail in relationships or in, you know, communicating the right thing to your friends or trying to build a relationship, I think that is, that can be a failure, and you learn from it to change, to be a better person, to do that. But I think it's hard to compare. And for me, it wasn't anything like this with the Hack Your Closet.
I wanted to follow up on what you just said, Lisa, and that is, if you actually see Hack Your Closet as a failure, which you said you don't, you see it a job well done, evaluating, you know, a very interesting idea. Is that a correct interpretation?
100%. Yeah, I mean, for people who are in our industry, understand what we achieved. We came so far in proving that there is something and that it can change, and we have used that experience and our operational experience to show to the big, you know, the big company that it's possible. We have been talking to them. We approached them. We were sitting on the European Commission representing the voice of startup. If that is a failure, I don't know what success is then, because I think we did very well. I think what didn't work out is, you know, something that was completely out of our control. I mean, you see, we're not the only one who had a difficult time. What we succeeded as is being able to see it and deal with it and be like, what do we do in this situation? There's a war, there's a recession. How can we continue? How can we carry on? And what kind of shape does that take? And sometimes it takes the shape of a bankruptcy, but it doesn't mean it's the end. It just means that this is what's the best right now for us to continue in the future.
Yeah, and I think it's also important maybe for our listeners to understand, or at least I think that's the view of this pod, is that through media you can easily get like, oh, this idea didn't work or this company didn't work, and that's equal to failure. So, but I think what we're trying to discover here is also that you have multiple things in your everyday operations when you run a company where you are more successful, and when you totally fail, like trying a new target group, doing this or so on. And I personally think those are maybe the more nuanced things that are really interesting to discover, and I hope we will be able to do that. But maybe we can just start with, tell us about Hack Your Closet. How did it begin? What did you guys do? What was the business idea?
Yeah, you'll have to start, Lisa, because I guess you started it all.
Yes. So I think for as long as I can remember, I've always had this mission or felt the responsibility to not accept, you know, how things are being done in the fashion industry, but also feeling that, you know, collaborations, and there was a possibility for our society to be better at consuming and for everyone to come together and do that. And after running a marketplace and being myself having a lot of interest in secondhand fashion and all of the things that, you know, makes fashion a little bit more sustainable, I was looking at how, I think I've read an article not so long ago saying that now sustainable fashion is almost being seen as a luxury, is something that people, you know, especially in a time like we are experiencing right now, a mother of 5 kids that's at home cannot think about sustainability. She has other priority. Sustainability shouldn't be a luxury. It should be something that people, it should be just part of, you know, you're something that everyone should be able to afford. And I was really thinking about how can I create something that fits the current behaviors of people, stays within an affordable price, and really like disrupt as little as possible the current experience, so people can still enjoy clothes. Because at the end of the day, I love clothes. I love expressing myself with them, and so. I was talking together with one of my close contacts who is an investor, and he's been witnessing a little bit my journey before Hack Your Closet, and brainstorming and looking at different companies that were out there, from like subscriptions, rental, secondhand marketplace, and basically we took the whole thing and just like made one hybrid kind of model that could potentially, you know, really disrupt the fashion industry and bring into in a positive way. Because, you know, if you would have asked me 10 years ago the fashion industry, I would be like, yeah, we're better off, all of those fast fashion company. But now I'm like, no, we need to find a solution together. And yeah, this is what Hacker Closet was about. It's how can we collaborate, how can we support you know, an existing problem, which was a a lot of waste, a lot of unsold goods that you know, came out of having a lot of different season every year, and also some, you know, supply issues. And then how can we make that available to customers who, you know, don't have the means to commit to an item and purchase that, but are willing to basically use those items and give them a second chance and just wear them as much as possible to maximize their value.
And Michaela, when did you come into the company?
Yeah, so since I was little, I think I've always been like an entrepreneur or entrepreneur, because I've always, like, on the street was the one making up the place, the theater. I always wanted to be in the center of attention, taking all of the decisions when I was little, a true actress back then. And then the creativity part came more in place when I joined, when I went to KTH for engineering in mechanics and design product development, and then master in innovation management. And there is where you get like organized creativity in innovation management. And I did the master's in circular economy and got really interested about circular models and how can you actually take something that has been sold once and then resell it 30 times again and have a lot of extract the whole value of the actual good? Because a lot of value is just going to waste today. And so I was looking at the startup scene, because there I could have the freedom of creativity and also the decision making in early stages, and also looking at circular business models and sustainability overall. And I found Lisa and her business. And so that's how I contacted, and that's how we came in contact and yeah, clicked.
I have a question, and I work with a lot of startups linked to Chalmers, and they are typically based on some research, which means that when I get in touch with the entrepreneurs, they have some technology, but they don't really know type of problem this technology could solve. I think in your case, you started off with a perfect problem, the fast fashion. But I'm wondering, what proof did you have when you actually started Hacker Closet that the solution that you were offering would actually work? Do you have any key learnings that you sort of use to build the whole idea about Hacker Closet beyond the problem, which is a great problem?
I think the learnings I had was actually not about our problem, was about how to build a functioning business model. I've worked with subscription before. I have seen, you know, the unit economics behind, and I thought I could do it in a better way. So then you completely exclude the problem and what we're doing. It's like, how do we also build a business model that's sustainable over time, right? But I have to say, the problem wasn't fast fashion. The problem was the clothes that we're not using long enough. And I came to not peace with it, but to an understanding where, I mean, fast fashion and like the, you know, the companies like H&M have made like, you know, fashion available to a lot of people, and have giving us the capacity to, you know, find our styles and tell who we are by the clothes we wear without having to spend a lot of money. And I think that in itself is not really the problem. Is, you know, how I think it went out of control, and there is something about, you know, overproducing, not using the clothes enough, you know, consumer changing, and then, you know, those companies who have been there for hundreds of years and have been building up on something that was so unachievable in the past is, you know, I think the real problem is not fast fashion, is maybe what's coming after that, right? Like all of the dropshipping company, the the real-time fashion or the things that feels like real-time fashion, but you know, takes 1 month to come because they're being shipped by boat and it's terrible for the environment. This is the real problem, because then there's a company who actually leverage behaviors that have been created a little bit out of control of the fast fashion company that we know of, and are taking that to a whole different scale with zero interest in the environment. I think what happens with the Inditex and the H&M group is, you know, they've been there for so long, and they've created a legacy. They've created an industry that, you know, like Meta and Facebook. I mean, no one knew what was going to happen with those companies if you look at them 10 years ago, right? So it's a bit out of their control, and now they are taking the responsibility to fix it. But meanwhile, we have those companies who are so far ahead when it comes to technology and engineering that they're catching up and they're leveraging on something and creating something just terrible that scares the shit out of me.
Can I add to that? Because I know that when you were thinking about the problem, like in the very, very beginning of the journey, we were almost only working and looking at secondhand. And I know that you love the secondhand market in Sweden. You thought it was great, and you didn't understand why people didn't buy more secondhand, because you can get great items, sometimes new, very good quality, good brands for a cheap price. So that was also something that you saw early on. I wonder why nobody was, or more people were buying secondhand.
Yeah, I mean, I moved from Berlin, where secondhand is very like a vintage style, is very like old school. Like you take things from your, like, you know, you look a little bit more like your grandmother, or you go completely like, I don't know, you know, you find your own thing. But what I liked about Sweden is like, because there is a heritage of like timeless designs in general and minimalism, that even in secondhand you could find something that was very relevant for today's fashion.
That's very nice to describe the Scandinavian trend of black, white and gray in the autumn.
Yeah, but it works, right?
Yeah. But so maybe we can go back and can you break down for us sort of what you've seen as the company progressed from this idea to up and running? What was the first milestone for you guys?
I think it's when Michaela joined, first of all, because I mean, you can be one person and then, you know, that's just an idea and a person. And then when you're two, you become a team, and that's a big milestone, I think. And then also, like, together, we, you know, we grew to like 200 customers, and, you know, it was like, I mean, both bringing our knowledge, either as, you know, being more creative, or me taking all of the insight I had from my background, things came into place like it was meant to be. And I was like, oh my God, we're onto something. Like everything from the unit economics, the KPIs, how we were doing things, how we were learning. Like it's, I think that was a big, you know, just before we actually then raised our first round, that was a big milestone for me.
Yeah. And I remember in the early days, we were super happy, or at least like on the operational side, super happy when we signed the contract with a delivery partner that could deliver to people's home, because we were shipping to post offices and we didn't have anyone to pick up the boxes neither. So we were going to the post office at first with all of the boxes in IKEA bags, and then there were too many, so we were ordering an Uber to go to the post office because it was quite far away. And so when we actually signed like the delivery partner that could come to the office and pick up all of the boxes for the operation part, like super nerdy, but that was a milestone. And then when we discovered also how we could track the items, before we like had a spreadsheet where we put the name of all of the items and the color and who it went to. But when we started actually tracking and started building the software for it, it became more real.
And actually, that's quite interesting. I find it, maybe I'm also a bit nerdy, have a lot of friends working with logistics, and I'm always impressed by entrepreneurs in logistics, because it's, I'm not going to swear or curse on the podcast, but it's hard. So did you have any a lot of people start out, I feel like you guys did, like you pack everything yourself, you drive, you go wherever you need. Was there any particular point where you're like, this is not gonna be sustainable, like we're not gonna be able to deliver on our, for example, promise to the customer if we don't find a way to, for example, have a delivery service or a more automated system?
Yeah, I think that it became very, very clear when we started growing. And as Lisa said, we had 200 customers when it was only me and her in the beginning. So it was already, you know, 3 to 5 items per customer that we needed to take home and wash at home. And so there was a lot of things that were physically like piling up and that we could see with our own eyes that this is not going to work. So finding partners that could help us with washing, finding partners that could help us with delivery, started building from the scratch of a Excel to actually a software that could track things. Those kind of small things we did was because we could see with our own eyes that it's stacking up.
Also, I think what was very encouraging and very nice to experience was to see that all of those partners, I mean, we had to create custom solutions because we had a very specific logistic, like, you know, the box had to go to the customer and then come back and we need to do all of that. And they knew we were a small company, but they knew the potential of it and they were willing to actually make this extra mile and sign up for us, even though we were doing, you know, probably it was not really significant for them as a client, but they were still willing to make that effort because they saw the potential of you know, our collaboration in the future. And that happened on all level, logistics, partners, brands, everyone really, you know, I don't think we've had a lot of what's it, rejections or something. Everyone was very, very excited.
Mm. And the software also customized because we couldn't find a software that could handle the circular flow. All of the warehouse logistics software were built for, you know, sales, and then a return is something negative in the system, and then you can't really make the same flow again with a return. So a lot of those things came clear that we needed to build something ourselves.
A question related to that, when you actually started off, you know, running the business from your home, as I understand, what list of questions did you have that you said, okay, wonder if this could work? Was it, will people actually sign up? Assuming that was one of the questions that you wanted to answer, will people be interested? But did you have any questions related to logistics and how to make the machinery actually work efficiently? Or was that something you discovered when you started?
So I think that the dangerous part of what I mentioned is that when we started, really things came so into place. Like, you know, I don't know if it means a lot for people who are listening, but when I was running some acquisition campaign on social media and so on, and literally our acquisition cost was like €5. And I was like, oh my God. And it felt like we got cracked. We found it, like, you know, the messaging, what we were proposing to customers. So it's like we really learned as it was growing and we had to figure it out then. And that's the reason also why at some point we started looking at, hey, how can we scale our inventory? Because right now we have secondhand clothes. And now we started thinking about, okay, there's another problem with, you know, unworn clothes. It's unsold goods that brands are having. Can we talk to them? Can we have those? And then we tackled that challenge. And then it was, okay, how do we, now we're deriving our customers to Stockholm, but you know, if we want to grow, we're going to need to go to other region. How do we do this? And it was really like an agile process almost. It's like you learn, and then you hit that roadblock. We're like, okay, now we're reaching this ceiling where we need a solution to get to the next level. And I think, you know, when you look sometimes at roadmaps or like pitch deck of companies and you see like a nice, smooth curve, you're like, this is not how a real startup looks like. I think it's more like a stair, you know, you do something and then you hit the roadblock and then you go a little bit higher, you reach that next level, you cruise a little bit, you figure things out, you try to make things a bit stable, then you hit the next level to reach and it goes on like this.
Yeah.
or it's very messy. It depends.
Yes.
Sorry, Michaela.
No, as Lisa said, I don't think we had any like super clear questions in the beginning, but of course we did change like the style survey that we had, because we had personal styling. We did change that. I mean, from the first styling survey that we had, it didn't look the same on the last day of the company. So we changed that continuously all the time. And it's about finding the market fit. But I think one thing that Lisa did in the beginning when she was alone was to actually just do a website and see if people will pay and a campaign, and then they did. So that question of like, will they actually come in and pay, that was already solved when I joined, and like really, really early, before you even like, okay, this is actually a company that we can build.
And also, I think what really happened, and that was some of the insights I took from my previous experience, was that before Michaela came, what I was running and the test that I was running, I was profitable. So I was not losing any money. I was, you know, it was not a lot of customers. Like maybe I think I grew to like 30 customers for my living room. And, you know, they were paying, they were staying, and then the revenue I was getting, I would reinvest that. And at some point I had enough so I could actually hire Michaela to join in. And then we started to raise capital and then go in a different direction. But things that I really try to accomplish is to make sure that the unit economics were correct already from the beginning, so I could just invest and just take the time to really look at what was happening and understand how we scale that in the future.
And was it a given for you guys to raise capital, or?
Yeah.
Yeah. And why was that? Was it because of the type of volumes that you needed to?
Yeah, I think there was, I mean, at the end, we were developing a predictive model. So we knew we would have to invest in engineering and tech. We were in need of like warehousing and things like that. And it's not something you can achieve if you just go with, you know, your earnings. That would have been very, very slow. Since it's been now a year and a half, and I go back and forth whether external financing is a good thing or not, it depends. But at the time, yes, it was clear that we were going to raise capital.
There's a certain psychology to entrepreneurship, which I've experienced myself, and that when you are in certain stages, there are questions that psychologically you might avoid because they are really tough. And if you have traction and there are other things going, you sort of tend to focus on positive things. But there are questions that might be, you know, lingering somewhere, and you avoid to ask them because you're sort of focused on succeeding. Now, in hindsight, in reflecting, were there anything now that you think of that actually there were questions that today might ask yourself with the experience you have if you would do something similar again? Anything you discovered afterwards that you avoided to talk about in the team?
I have something on a personal level, but it might be a big topic, so I'm not sure we have the time to talk about it. I had the chance and the opportunity to have a female entrepreneur as a mentor who never, ever made me feel like my gender meant anything. So I've never really... I've always came into a room thinking I'm just an entrepreneur. I've completely blocked out the possibility that someone would treat me a different way because I was a woman. And I, unfortunately, it makes me very sad, but I think it did happen and I didn't want to see it. So I just, and I think it affected a lot what happened and how much was expected from us and unfortunately. So I don't know if it would have changed something, if I would have accepted that and maybe try to change things a little bit, but I believe that we were treated differently because of that, and I didn't want to see it.
Yeah, maybe linked to that, like with the capital that we took in from VC investors, I think that the things that you need to achieve in order to get capital again and to achieve the numbers that you need, you have to run really, really fast. And I think that maybe questions around was it right to take in that amount of capital from these investors that early, or was it right to like expand to a different market that early because it was needed for the next round to show those metrics? Was it right to go with the flow of following the metrics more than looking inwards and like following what our business model actually needed? I think those questions, we had them in the back of our head, and of course we discussed them and we took the decisions, but in hindsight I think that we would have needed to think about it properly, and like just me and Lisa and the team.
I don't think it's necessarily any right or wrong, because you take decisions upon that situation, and I think it's even more tricky to not be able to make a decision, which I think a lot of entrepreneurs sometimes find themselves also like trying to have all doors open at the same time. But do you have any advice or things that if you find yourself in a situation like this where you might need to do something pivotal, like how to approach it? What have you learned from the things you've done so far?
For me, it's very simple. It's trust my gut feeling, not someone else's. And that might be a bit reductive to, you know, but it's like, I think I've been wanted to trust people around us and make collaborative decisions. But at the end of the day, those, you know, those partners, collaborators, whatever, they weren't there when, you know, we raised from there. They weren't there when we were building the business, and their opinion matters, but our gut feeling as entrepreneurs and as founders matters more.
Yeah, and for me, it's not opposite, but almost, because I have a very hard time knowing what my gut feeling says. So for me, it's about collecting information from different sources and getting the different perspectives and then making a decision out of that. And I think that if we would have spoken also with business builders more and entrepreneurs and people that have done a similar like circular journey, that could have maybe also told us a little bit more rather than just listening to one side of the story.
And we spoke a bit before, me and Håkan. So the first round you guys took, that was a seed round, and you had quite a few investors, which is not always the case. How can you tell us a bit about how that came to be, and also if there, my first thought when I heard that was it sounded a bit crowded with that many investors in a seed round, but what was your experience of it?
Okay, I think there's a background story that people don't talk about. So when I had a venture before Hack Your Closet, when I joined Spotify and I decided to take a break from venture, from being an entrepreneur, I took the decision to keep my investor on the cap table. At the time, though, I was a newbie, and I would never know if that was a good or bad decision, right? Because at the end of the day, I wanted to show my investors that I valued their engagement with me, their commitment, their belief and their trust, and I didn't want to throw that away just because. And I wanted to show them that I was on a mission for ever, and that I wanted them to, you know, to be part of that. So when we raised actually a first angel round, so for Hack Your Closet, we already had a bunch of VCs and on the cap table, which made it quite complicated now in hindsight. And I'm very, very thankful that at the seed round, we actually were pushed to restructure the company, because I never saw it. I thought, you know, this is a collaboration. I trust those partners. They care about us. I think they did, but at the end of the day, they are VCs, right? So they have, you know, they have most of them, especially in pre-seed and seed, they have huge amount of portfolio companies, and they don't, you know, it's the principle of not putting all of your eggs in the same basket kind of thing. And I wanted to believe that they really care about us. So I wanted to show that in return. I don't know what would have happened if I didn't do that. Because some of them continue investing. That's the reason why I have a strong network today, because people know I'm, you know, we were reliable and we did that, but it was a bit of a hard, you know, didn't make it easier in the future when we did our seed round and our pre-seed.
But bringing them on that early, was that a gut feeling to do that?
Yeah. I felt responsible for it.
Yeah. But that's also something that, from the sound of it, you learned that maybe it was not, in this case, a good decision. So have you developed your gut feeling now, or...
It's so difficult to answer these kind of questions, because I, you know, when I was brainstorming with, I don't know if I can, I mean, I'm going to name them because they are so important in our journey, is Lumina Venture. When Jacob came to me and we were brainstorming together about this idea, he knew about everything. And I think till this day, we still exchange email, we still brainstorm. And I think, and that's the difference, right? It's like, it's a journey. We're building a relationship that, you know, has, you know, started maybe when I had another venture or when I was working for a startup, and then those discussions happening and the way the decision I make and I share with those people have made them believe that, you know, we feel responsible and we want to, you know, we want to maintain a level of, I don't know how to call it, but, you know, that it's an important thing to do as an entrepreneur. So I don't know, maybe if I didn't do it, I wouldn't have those contacts today. And if, again, my gut feeling was that I was responsible for it, I had to do it. And it might have been different, but I will never know. I would have done it again just because of where we are today, actually.
It sounds to me that actually the decision you made was to bring on people, because business is made with people. So that you have a network of people you trust, not really the VCs, but the people. And those were the ones you decided to bring on the cap table. And they happen to represent VCs.
Very much. That's a very good way to put it together. And and I think it's the right thing for all businesses. Even for me today, I can say that all businesses is the people people coming together. So definitely.
Talking about people, I think it's interesting because it's already on your answers now clear that you're very different people, you two. It seems like, Lisa, you're more the gut feeling person, and Michaela, you're more, you know, facts and figures. And is that a good way of putting it, or?
Yeah, me and Lisa are very different in, I think, what we like to work with and how, you know, we structure our work, etc. But we are also very similar in how we see things and what we like, and we have similar interests. And I think that we complement each other very, very well. She's the visionary. She pushes the vision forward and makes us run. And then I come and, you know, clean and like put everything in order and make it work.
I think that sounds pretty solid, because it's quite hard to work with people who's only visionary or who's only realistic, because then you kind of never move in any direction. But I'm curious, what was the proudest moment for you guys during the journey with Hack Your Closet?
I think there's so many that I remember that I'm like super happy about. It almost always ties down to the team, like when we have achieved something together, or when we, you know, the small wins that we shipped on time, or we achieved 10 pallets this week, you know, the small wins that makes it really nice. And then the feedback that we got from the team, and when we won a pitch competition, we won quite many prizes along the journey. And also being on Ellen MacArthur Foundation, a very renowned player in the circular economy industry. I mean, they invented the whole concept. And I think being invited to the EU, etc. I think there are small wins along the journey that you will remember for life.
And did you, I mean, it's different what you feel, when you're in the company and you kind of see the everyday business, and then what people externally see as this was the peak of that company, or this was when everyone believed it was gonna really establish. But is there any point in your journey when you feel that this is gonna work, like this is gonna break through? And when was that then?
Well, I mean, the reason, I think, you know, as I said, I still see it as a success because, you know, I mean, I'm very committed to this mission about the fashion industry. And what I've learned now is just, you know, one stone in continuing doing that. But, you know, one thing that there was many, you know, in the balance when we took the decision to close, there was a lot of things, a lot of discussion that has been made with like investors that were not even involved, with, you know, friends, teams, family. And I think most entrepreneurs, and I think for us, it was important to create that impact, that global impact with what we were creating. And we accepted that the way it was and the direction it took, it would have been very difficult for us to achieve that. So I think that, I mean, now today, think about the business model, there's a lot of things that's just, you know, would have need to change. And therefore there was of course, at the beginning, you know, when the two of us were like, oh my God, this is going to go to the moon. And, you know, you're super excited and you get all of those collaborations. But, you know, to be completely transparent, that's also why we actually decided that it was not the right time now, because we didn't have the tools and we didn't have the setup for us to take that globally. You know, a lot of companies in the past 2 years have been, you know, seeing down rounds and being diluted to the max. And how do you do that if you want to be like, how do you continue in that setup to build a global company? You can't. So you have to decide, you know, am I still devoted to this mission? Do I still want to do that? And what do I have today to do to achieve that? I can take a break and keep the learnings and continue in a better time, or I just hustle and keep the lights on. And then we never achieve what that actual goal that is the most important thing for us, was to actually make a difference.
So it was a bit like, go home, or go big or go home, so to speak. Yeah,
yeah, very much. And I think when it comes to sustainability, very much. I think you have, like, if we need something to happen, and we need to happen something that is large. And even, you know, we were in both market, France and Sweden, and that was not big enough for me. I needed to be bigger. And discussing with different advisors, I saw the limitation that we impose of ourselves and things that we didn't do that basically would have made it very difficult. And now that I've taken a step back, now I have the solutions, but I think I would never have had the solutions while we were doing it, because there was too much pressure and there was other priorities to tackle that, unfortunately, limited ourselves.
So what do you guys see today that could have been maybe a pivotal thing to change, that you would have still run the company? Just out of curiosity.
Well,
I mean, I have things on the operational side, but I don't know if it's... I mean, I think as we had... we had 70,000 garments on rotation, and we needed large warehouses. At the same time, we needed to cut costs. And how do you do that when you need a large warehouse, for example? Well, you have to move probably to another city where it's cheaper. But as we started in Stockholm, where the prices are quite high, and we got our best stylists and our employees that lived in Stockholm, we didn't want to, you know, move to another city and either relocate the team, but from their families, or find a new team. So that size became difficult. Then we managed to do it in France and start over with a cheap space there. So I think the unit economics were better in France, of course, because of that, or not the unit economics, but the costs.
I can add on this. I think what we, at the time, so I think just before COVID, I think there was quite a, like VCs were quite eager when it comes to consumer startup. There was a lot of things going on, and especially in logistics and all of the kind of consumer services you can think of. And the word that always came back to founders was operational excellence. And we were like, we were being completely like, in like our shareholders and people was obsessed about, oh, we have to create operational excellence, like operational excellence. We have to pack a box within less 10 seconds and this for 5 seconds and this and this and that. And we were so focused on getting there. And we were, I mean, with what Michaela did, like we achieved the best unit economics and KPIs that you can see for the model we've had, I would say in Europe. I have no doubt about this. But what happened with this is that we were so focused on these seconds and those minutes and, you know, the lead times and all of those different things that we forgot that we were actually sending those boxes to our customers, that there's a user experience, that it needs to feel good, that it needs to feel, yeah, like... I think that was our biggest mistake. Like we were pushed, or we felt like we had the responsibility to work out those KPIs when actually we didn't even nail the user experience. How does it feel to open the box? How does it feel to touch the clothes? And when we started, just the two of us, we only had that in the back of our mind. So we had a handwritten note. We were packaging it in a way because we had the time and we only had a few customers. And that made the whole difference, because at the time we had less returns, people were more happy with the clothes, they were feeling a whole different experience. And as we scaled, we became more of a logistic company and less of a consumer company. And that was a big problem, I think. And where today I rather start with the consumer, make sure that all of my five first customers are so happy that they talk about what they're experiencing with their friends, than, you know, scaling too fast and not nailing that experience and not making sure that you can do the same thing for, you know, a million people.
Yeah, I think that was the biggest thing of all.
And when did you discover this, and how did you discover this?
I mean, for me, I think we discovered it after we shut down the company, unfortunately, because we were still super, super focused on, you know, raising the Series A round, and there you have to have the metrics, and for those metrics to show, you have to have this amount of growth per month. So we were aiming for that. We were aiming for getting as many customers in as possible and sending out the boxes on time. But then we missed on quality. And so I think we figured it out, like, you know, it was too late.
And do you think investors are, do you think that there's like a lack in the VC and investor space of understanding like both sides that usually is needed for a company to succeed, both growth, of course, and sustainable growth, but also this retention, ensuring that users are actually, not that you get like one in, one out quickly, or what did you meet in the investor landscape?
I think that they, if you ask them, they, of course, I mean, everyone understands that a good retention is important, right? And you don't want, and churn is a bad number and all those different things. But, you know, understanding that they, that you cannot do the both at the same time, and something might not be scalable, but that might be sustainable over time, I think is something that we should have been better also at pitching. And saying like, hey, look, we're not raising to, you know, like we should have like first, you know, nail this user experience, show like, hey, now we know how to scale that. But instead we're like, hey, we have a good business now. Let's just shoot to the stars and just go very fast. And then, you know, and I think it's never, you know, I don't think there's no one to blame. I think there's everyone to blame. There's us as founders to see it and be able to also fight for those ideas. And then there's VCs also having their own pressure. Everyone has a boss, right? So, and having to deliver and to basically help. I think they wanted to help us raising, and they thought this was the message that we needed to deliver to be able to raise. And maybe they got that from other experiences and different backgrounds. And at the end, we just, we stop following our gut feelings because we have too many opinions in the same, you know, from all sides.
I see also a big difference between funds that have partners that have built companies before and that are entrepreneurs themselves, because they have a bigger understanding of what a problem is. It's just an obstacle that you need to overcome, right? And they don't blow it up as much as other funds do. So I think that, I don't know, I would actually today go for more entrepreneurial funds that have built companies before and that know what it's about.
100%.
That's a good advice, maybe for some of the listeners. But I'm also curious to dive into. So before we started recording this, I spoke with a colleague of mine, and it turns out that his partner loved your service, and she's also loved a lot of other services that's tried to bring this circular economy into fashion. But unfortunately, she's had to try new ones because there's been tough to succeed in this space. What's your, if we step away from your company and more talk about challenging the fashion industry, changing consumer behavior and so on, why do you guys think it's been hard for these types of companies to succeed?
Well, it's not really, it's a few things. The first one is, I mean, right now, every investor, it doesn't, like, there's really few investors who are doing consumer product. That's just how it is, right? Going for B2B, software services, this kind of things, or like, I don't know, a different industry they're focusing on and a bit like longer tail kind of things. I think they're a bit afraid of, you know, where consumers are going, how things are going to change over time. So that is, and it's not only for our like circular model, I would say for all consumers right now is very difficult. And honestly, like, I think we've been discussing that also with some of our former investors. Like, I think, you know, we came the furthest, but I would have to say that there's no players, and I can see now in that model that are going to be able to scale. It's just not. The way it was and the way that has been like tested by a lot of founders, it is not really a scalable model. And right now that's what's needed for really to make a difference. So,
So what you're saying is that your take with Hack Your Closet, as you know, seeing it as really a validation project on a great idea, proved that we will never see services on a global scale that where people will sort of rent clothes.
No, that's not what I said. I said the business model, the way it was set up, didn't work. When we used a lot the word modules when we talk about our business model, so it was built on modules on how and blocks of things that come together. Some to which worked very, very well, and some that didn't really work really well. I think it's possible rental will be big. Like circular economy, I mean, even the Ellen MacArthur Foundation says, you know, within 10 years is 700 billion, right? The market value. So it will be big, but it will not take the shape of what we did with Hack Your Closet. Like small tweaks of that business model needs to happen to really achieve that global scale.
I think this is an interesting topic because if I'm an investor, you know, want to actually go for the model that could work on a global scale, I would like to use someone that has hands-on experience of things that didn't work and figured out, okay, these are the components that we should use and these are the ones we should skip.
Yeah.
So, but one thing is then we need people like you guys to get into the saddle again. And is that at all on your agenda to actually, you know, take your experience and have a new shot at, you know, solving this issue, because the problem is still there?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that would be my biggest failure if I didn't.
Okay, so any things you can share on that, or are you just open for, so if someone is thinking about this, you would both be willing to sign up for have a new go?
Yeah, for 100%. Sure.
So it's just to get started up there. I'm thinking how I'm going to phrase this. it's still interesting. Like, was there anything that really surprised you during the journey and the industry itself that you you had no idea about before actually diving deep into working with this?
It's going to sound very maybe weird, but like, it's again, it's the importance of paper. And I think you actually understand, you know, you see the full spectrum of a relationship when you go through the highs and the lows. And, you know, we had partners when it happened who, you know, wrote us messages on, you know, personal messages. How are you doing? You know, this must be a difficult time. Bring a lot of empathy. Some people, you know, are still reaching out today, as I mentioned. Some, like, people we are still seeing. And there are some people who did that and some people who didn't. That we trusted and that we believed in. And that shows a little bit like how, you know, how does that work when you work with people and who can you, you know, that was my biggest learning. I don't know if that really answered the question and if it's very clear, but I would say, yeah, relationships for me is the thing I learned the most. And, you know, also when it comes to the team, for example, I saw it happening and I didn't do anything about it, but it's like, you know, we were so focusing on getting things done and we had so much pressure that we stopped celebrating our small successes. We didn't spend as much time together as a team, and the human factor is so important because, you know, you always meet someone twice, and then you also build. Yeah, I think that's the one that I wish I was more aware of. And it seems logical that, you know, people are important, but, you know, sometimes it's not that simple.
Michaela, what's your biggest takeaway or learning from all of this?
A lot of things. This was my, like, steepest personal growth journey ever in my life. both as, like, trying to lead people along the journey, having 45 employees, you know, a lot of company building that I learned from Lisa as a great mentor, and a lot of things. And I think that one key takeaway now right after the journey was, like, I realized that my identity is Hager Closet. And, like, when I presented myself to other people, I said, well, I'm one of the founders of Hacker Closet. So I had a bit of a identity crisis after the journey. And I think that the realization is to really build your brand along a company building journey and be sure to also, you know, separate yourself from the business and know who you are really without the business as well. I think that's super important, and you often realize that too late. But besides that, I think a lot of things around, you know, operations and company building, and I didn't know anything about logistics first when I went in, but now I know everything about a circular business flow of logistics, and the problems in the industry. There's a lot of things that I take with me. But just as an example, the personal brand and identity that you have as a person is really important to remember and stay truth to.
I think that's a very good advice that we actually heard from other guests in this podcast. Yeah, as startup entrepreneurs, you tend to get sort of totally entangled with your company. And I guess there are two sides to that, but I think probably from a person perspective, your advice is a very good one. I wanted to change the subject a little bit and go back to something you mentioned before, Lisa, about, you know, a question that you didn't really thought about, that you took it for granted that you would be treated as an entrepreneur the same way as male entrepreneurs. We know for a fact that that's not the case. There are so much numbers, facts and numbers that, you know, what you like, Michaela, that shows that we are not equal. So I wanted to ask maybe a little bit of a wrap up of this podcast. Have a little bit maybe your thoughts about what does it take to change that, and any advice to female founders out there how to manage the situation.
So actually now I'm running a accelerator program for female founders called Time to Raise, and this questions and these thoughts come up a lot during this time, and also how I pitch the program, etc., depends on who I'm talking to. But I think that there are, of course, obstacles that you need to overcome as a female founder. You have to show a lot more metrics and results, and you get a little bit of different questions than a male. But I would actually also say that you get a lot of benefits because we are fewer females running companies. And I think that we should sort of, an advice is to ride on that wave, like take those extra articles that you get in the news. Take those extra articles, the interviews that you get, the competitions that you can be on and the stages that you can be on, because these players need to also balance the genders. I think it's a good thing to actually ride on that sad wave to your benefit. And I think that we need more female entrepreneurs as role models in order for more females to start companies from the beginning. Because I do believe that the numbers look like they do as well, because we are fewer building companies. I think that it's both cons and pros with it. And I think that we should all ride on the pros and just screw the cons.
Yeah. Or Lisa, sorry, did you?
No, I was just going to pick up on my part of him, but maybe you wanted to add something.
No, go ahead.
No, I tend to always, I genuinely going to say, I really never thought about me as a female. Like I would go into a room, I didn't even think about who was in the room, what age they were, and because I've never been told to. I was so lucky. Like, she's changed everything for me, because my own mentor in Berlin, like, it was never a topic. So it was not really part of my DNA, like even my thoughts to have that. But I think we should, now if I would have a second shot at it, I think I would have the courage to ask the right question to potential collaborators. I don't actually care if you're, all of your partners are male, or if you have one female partner. I don't really care about this, but I want to know, who are the female founders you invested in? Why did you invest in them? I want to hear from them. I want to know that this, is it going to be like 20% of your portfolio, or is it actually going to be a fair, 50%? Is it 20 because you're desperately trying to match your quotas, or is it 20 because you believe in those people? And actually not being, sometimes as founders, we're so desperate for fundings because we just believe so much in our company, we wanted to see it happen, that we compromise on what we really believe in and what are important to us. And we take in investors that might not be suitable for ourselves. And now I would make no compromises. I would ask the question I believe are important to me. And if they're not answered, I will go to the next person.
That's really interesting. And I was going to just ask lastly, in terms of, has anything changed for you guys in how you cope with, failures, or how we want to frame it, or setbacks, or can be external, can be internal, during the last couple of years?
I was so scared about what the majority would think before we decided to bankrupt the company. I was really, really scared about what other people would think about that sort of failure. Now looking back at it and the journey after Hacker Closet, it's super positive. And the people that understand that we did everything that we could and that failure has brought us to a lot of learnings are the people that I want to surround myself with. And so I look at failure now as, okay, I'm not going to swear, but we actually took the risk of building a company and a quite difficult business model and a fun one, and like changing our customer behavior. And I think that we did a lot of things that out of naivety or out of not caring about if we would fail at all. I think if you think too much about mistake and failure, never try. And I think that we would have been so much more careful if we would have thought about the risks that we took. So, yeah, I see it as a strength to not think about failures too much. And I think that failures are just learnings.
Do you want to add anything, Lisa?
I don't really. I think I've always had a very... A very transparent relationship with the failures and very clear and I would see it as healthy. I think one thing that I've learned now, and I don't know if that's, you know, hopefully it's on topic, but, you know, now I've been employed for over a year, and I'm very thankful for that, because, you know, as a CEO also sometimes it's a very lonely place to be. You never really, and being employed, you realize, you know, the lack of communication you might have had, or of transparency, of like really spending the time with your team and the people who are actually, you know, getting the things done and carrying your vision. I wish I've had that perspective then, because I would have been in a completely different CEO, I would say. So that's more my learning now, post Hack Your Closet and what I'm doing at the moment. You know, learning and taking all of the failure I had as a CEO, and I hope that one day I will be a better one.
That's a really good way to conclude, I think, this episode. Thank you so much, guys, for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.